Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast. I'm your host, JP Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, The Steppe, and The Birth of the Russian Empire. And this is Episode 2, The Urheimat. Last episode, we looked at the physical setting of our story. The great forested plain of Eastern Europe and the steppe grasslands running from Hungary to Mongolia. In this episode, we will begin to look at the early human population in the plain and the first major cultures to arise there. Our story starts in British India. Scholars called Pandits, from which we derive the English word pundit, would cite ancient Hindu law in court. The British had some difficulty determining what was and what was not, in fact, ancient law. And so, in 1783, a Welsh lawyer named William Jones was sent to Calcutta on a mission to investigate this ancient Hindu law so that it could be integrated with British legal practices in India. Jones was from a talented family. His father, also William Jones, was a mathematician who introduced the use of the pi symbol, and Jones the younger demonstrated a flair for languages from an early age. In addition to English and Welsh, he learned Greek, Latin, Persian, Arabic, Hebrew, and some Chinese while still a boy, and produced the first Persian-English dictionary while still in his early 20s. He would eventually learn 8 languages to what he called complete thoroughness, be fluent in 8 more, and speak another 12 with reasonable competence. In India, he learned Sanskrit, and naturally compared it to other languages that he knew. This led him to believe that Sanskrit, Greek, and Latin were all derived from a common root, and that they were all probably related to Gothic, Celtic, and Persian as well. On February 2nd, 1786, he gave a presentation on the history and culture of the Hindus to the Asian Society, where he said, quote, "The Sanskrit language, whatever be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident. So strong, indeed, that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source, which, perhaps, no longer exists." End quote. Jones was not the first to note the similarities between these languages, seemingly quite separated by place and culture. But it was his ideas that attracted the most attention to the subject, which are often seen as the beginning of Indo-European studies. He suggested that Sanskrit had been brought into India by an Aryan invasion of lighter-skinned northerners. The idea that somewhere in the ancient past there was a people who came to be referred to as Aryans, actually a misnomer and merely a word that early Iranian peoples used to refer to themselves, who spoke a language that we now call Proto-Indo-European, which became the source for languages spoken today from Scandinavia to India, fascinated many and stimulated a search for its linguistic homeland, the place where these people had lived. In linguistics, we call a proto-language homeland an Urheimat, from the German for original home. These investigations, beginning as they did without the benefit of extensive archaeological records, and at a time when rather dubious ideas were treated as science, where scholars were operating without a theoretical and factual framework, had a tendency to wander off into the weeds. Sometimes this resulted in ideas that sounded reasonable to the classically educated people of the time, but pretty weird to us, like William Jones thinking that Sanskrit could have been brought to India by Egyptian priests, or that the Chinese were descended from ancient Hindus. Other times, it could be more sinister, as theories about ancient Indo-Europeans were combined with the racialist ideas gaining currency in the age of colonialism to justify claims to superiority and land. 100 years after William Jones, a German philologist and archaeologist, Gustav Kossinger, decided that the Proto-Indo-European Urheimat was in Schleswig-Holstein. He identified the corded ware culture, a population that made a particular kind of ceramics, with the ancestors of the Germans, which made the lands that they inhabited German lands, which meant that the Germans had a historic right to Poland, Czechoslovakia, and other parts of Central and Eastern Europe. Kossinger's ideas would play a key role in the development of Nazi ideology and the idea that it was the Germans who were the Aryans, and that's why we don't call Proto-Indo-Europeans Aryans anymore. As an interesting podcast footnote, in the Komi and Udmurt languages spoken in northwest Russia and on the Volga, Aryan means slave, an echo of the ancient north-south rivalries between the forest and the steppe. However, research continued through archaeology, linguistics, and in more recent times, DNA studies. And today, there is a fair amount of consensus around the Proto-Indo-European Urheimat. There are three candidates worth consideration, and they are, in reverse order of the degree of acceptance, in third place, the Armenian hypothesis, which puts the ancient Proto-Indo-European homeland south of the Caucasus. This hypothesis relies most on recent DNA research. Second, the Anatolian hypothesis, which places the homeland in Anatolia, that is, modern Turkey, around 8000 BCE. And in first place, and most important for our story, is the steppe hypothesis, which puts the Indo-European Urheimat in the Pontic-Caspian steppe, the southern part of the East European plain we talked about last episode, modern southern Russia and Ukraine, about 4000 BCE. Now, if you're not familiar with this area, you might be saying to yourself, okay, I can understand DNA studies. Archaeology is pretty obvious. But how can linguists tell us where an extinct people who spoke an extinct language lived? And how do we know these languages are related anyway? After all, the French son might be written like the Latin centum, even if they're pronounced differently. But what do either of them have in common with the word hundred? It's a good question. In the second half of the 19th century, in various places around the world, the groundwork was being laid for modern linguistics. At Kazan State University, the second oldest university in Russia, a Polish linguist and Slavist named Jan Mieczysław Ignacy Baudouin de Courtenay was working on synchronic linguistics, developing the concepts of static and dynamic aspects of language, and differentiating a language, that is, an abstract group of elements, and speech, that is, the way people use that abstract group of elements to convey meaning. Working with another Polish professor at Kazan State University, Mikolaj Habdank-Kruszewski, the pair took the notion of phonetics, a term that had recently been coined by French linguist Dufriche de Genette to refer to the set of sound units in a language, the noises which we, as human beings, are capable of making, and created a distinction between physical phonetic changes, which we call phonological changes, and psychophonetic changes, which we call morphological changes. For example, inserting an extra vowel sound into library, nuclear, or athlete, to say library, nuclear, or athlete, is a physical phonetic set change. People do it because they find it easier to insert a vowel sound than to have multiple consecutive consonant sounds. The difference between sing and sang, on the other hand, is a morphological change used purposefully to express meaning. In linguistics, these variations are called alternations. These ideas were extremely influential in linguistics. Hrushevsky went on to develop a systematic approach to the phonological structure of language in a work called On Sound Alternation. We don't need to go deep into the details here, but the key point is that he established that these variations in sound are regular, rules can be created to describe them, and reliable predictions can be made about how sounds will vary by using those rules. Just a quick illustration. If you are listening to this podcast somewhere where no one minds you making a noise, try saying E out loud, and then try saying "oh." You should feel that the E sound is made at the front of your mouth, while the "oh" is made at the back. So it will be easier to say consonants made at the back of your mouth with "oh," and consonants made at the front of your mouth with E. More than that, if you say a consonant normally made at the back of your mouth with a front vowel, the consonant will shift forwards and change somewhat, which is a process we call palatization. So what does this have to do with our subject of Proto-Indo-European? Well, by comparing languages, where there are written records comparing older texts to modern use, linguists can use these rules to reconstruct how language has changed, what even more archaic forms of words might have been, when languages split from each other, and all kinds of other information. So let's go back to those three words I mentioned earlier. Latin, centum, French, cent, English, hundred. How did we get from the first one to the other two? Although we usually read the C-E-N-T Latin syllable as cent in English, like in centurion, centimetre, century, and so on, the original pronunciation was with a hard C, centum. And though I've just distracted you with the spelling, remember we are talking about changes before widespread literacy, or before the invention of writing at all for many languages. So we need to think in terms of the sounds, the phonetics, rather than the written word. So the first linguistic rule we can note is that hard consonants tend to become soft. Kaiser to Caesar, and indeed Kaiser to Tsar, and Tsar to its English pronunciation, Tsar. This shift from a hard consonant to an S consonant is called a sibilization. So if we know that an initial k can become ts, which can become s, then we can see that cent, or the French son, could have derived from centum, or from the same origin as centum. But what about hundred? Here we are helped by another linguistic rule, Grimm's Law, named after Jacob Grimm of the Brothers Grimm. Although best known for his collections of folk tales, Grimm was a groundbreaking linguist and author of The History of the German Language. The law that bears his name describes a consistent shift in consonants from other Indo-European languages, and therefore presumably from Proto-Indo-European, that takes place in German. One of those shifts is initial k to initial h. And so from our centum-like source, we can get to hentum, and then to the Germanic root of hunde, from which we derive the English hundred. Looking around the Indo-European language family, we find that if we apply these consonant shift rules to the word for a hundred, we can say that they could all have come from a word that began with a hard k sound. The second consonant in these words is generally an N or M. And from other cases, we know that in Indo-European languages, M's may become N's, but not the other way around. So the second consonant in our proto-hundred was an M. In this way, by applying known rules of linguistic change, we can get back to a proto-Indo-European hundred of cumtum. And from there forwards again, along all the branches of Indo-European, to the modern cognates. Cognates are words derived from a common root. Linguists have been able to test this by applying the rules to predict archaic forms before they are discovered. Linguists looking at how we got from the reconstructed Proto-Indo-European word Gosti to Gothic, Old Norse, and Old High German Gasts, Gester, and Gast, those are all words for guest, in case you didn't guess, decided that there had to have been a Proto-Germanic form, Gastis, although no forms of guest with an I sound in the final syllable had been found. Some years later, archaeologists dug up a gold drinking horn in Denmark with the word Gastis engraved on it, confirming that the rules they were applying had been correct. So, how do these linguistic investigations give us information on the lives of Proto-Indo-Europeans, and why do we think they came from the Pontic steppe? Today, linguists have been able to reconstruct a couple of thousand Proto-Indo-European root words, and if we take English, for example, there are around 13,000 modern words that we can derive from those 2,000 roots. Looking at these reconstructed words, we find that Proto-Indo-Europeans had words for wild animals like otter, beaver, lynx, red deer, hare, moth, crane, and starling. For domestic animals, they had words for goat, swine, sow, cow, bull, sheep, lamb, and hound. These are all temperate zone animals. Sheep were introduced from the Middle East, but before the period we are looking at. There are no words for monkeys, tigers, or whales. There is a word for the horse, which originates from the steppe, but not for donkey, which comes from Africa, or camel, which comes from the Middle East. There is a word for apple, which originates from Central Asia, most likely Kazakhstan, but not for Mediterranean fruits like olives or grapes. There are very few words relating to vegetables. There are words for fish and sea. The word for sea, mir, can still be seen in the Russian mor. But in English, we have only kept it in words like mermaid or lake names like Windermere. There are words for bee, honey, and mead, an alcoholic drink made by fermenting honey. Honeybees were not found east of the Urals during the Bronze Age. We also have words for winter and snow. There are a number of important words for wheel, axle, wagon, and yoke that are also key to placing the Proto-Indo-Europeans. These words are phonetically native Proto-Indo-European terms, not borrowed words, and consistent enough to suggest that they, and therefore the technologies that they describe, spread very rapidly. Besides foods, animals, and tools, we also have some reconstructed Proto-Indo-European social vocabulary. The words for male relatives, father, uncle, brother, husband, nephew, and the husband's family members, can be followed through the Proto-Indo-European family tree, while the words for wives and wives' families are inconsistent or missing. The English words niece and nephew, for instance, come from the same Proto-Indo-European root word, as the Proto-Indo-Europeans did not seem to see a need for feminine terms. Linguists believe this reconstructed vocabulary shows a patriarchal family or clan structure in which young women would move into their husband's household. There are words for chief and warrior, but not for king or army or war. Taken together with the patriarchal structure, this implies a hierarchical raiding culture where young warriors would demonstrate their prowess and capture rival herds to pay a bride price, as has been observed in other pastoralist nomadic societies later in history. As mentioned above, there was a single word, Gosti, from which our guest and host and their cognates are derived. The combination of these meanings within a single word is believed to indicate that these were equal roles of reciprocal obligations. Think about the old sagas, where offering and accepting bread meant that you had a safe place to stay for the night. We also have some words relating to Proto-Indo-European religious beliefs. The best attested Proto-Indo-European god is Deus Pter, the Sky Father, personification of the daytime sun in the sky. As you might have already guessed, Deus Pter takes us to the Greek Zeus Pater and the Latin Jupiter, as well as the Vedic Deus Peter, the god of heaven, the Albanian sky god Zeus, Latvian Dievs, Old Prussian Deus, and Old English Tiu. Deus often had a consort earth goddess, but the reconstructions for her are much less consistent and secure, with some scholars regarding the associated fertility functions as too generic to indicate that there was a distinct Proto-Indo-European consort goddess. In an echo of the family structures I mentioned a few minutes ago, many of the contender consorts may have been other goddesses assimilated into a new position. Alongside Deus was Perkunos, the striker or lord of oaks, a weather god. He brought the rain to make the land fruitful and wielded a weapon called Mildon, meaning lightning hammer. I think this should be sounding familiar to all of you Marvel fans. In the Mediterranean, the weather god's functions largely merged with Deus, but in northern and western Europe, he retained a strong separate identity. Perkunos would become Perun, the highest god in the Slavic pantheon, god of the sky, thunder, lightning, storms, lore, war, fertility, and oak trees. He wields an axe called Molnia, Russian for lightning, an obvious counterpart to Thor's Mjolnir, and lived on the top of a forested mountain. As part of his conversion to Christianity, Vladimir the Great would throw down and break the idols of Perun that he himself had erected previously. Putting these reconstructed words together and looking at what they imply, we can start to deduce some things about the Proto-Indo-Europeans. Taking the words for animals and weather, we can say that they must have lived in a temperate area or on the European side of the Urals. The social vocabulary, combined with the lack of words for farming and vegetables, suggests that they were pastoralists living in patriarchal groups led by an experienced warrior. Their gods were personifications of natural phenomena rather than local divinities. They knew how to make alcohol, so they probably held feasts and religious celebrations. And there is some evidence in the reconstructed vocabulary for stock phrases that may have been used in epic poetry recited around the fire. By comparing cognates across different branches of the Indo-European family and the internal phonetics of Indo-European, we can make some assumptions about when words appeared, what is native Indo-European and therefore something that they invented, and what has been borrowed from another language, perhaps through trading in some new technology or invention. An example of the former is the language relating to horse riding, wagons and chariots, which we believe that the Proto-Indo-Europeans invented. As I mentioned last episode in our survey of the East European Plain, the horse originated from and was first domesticated on the Eurasian steppe. By taking these deductions made on the basis of this linguistics research and looking for a geographical area that would match them, we can see that there is a strong possibility that the Proto-Indo-European Urheimat was in the Pontic steppe around 4000 BCE, from whence Indo-European-speaking peoples spread out across Europe, the Middle East, and Central Asia so successfully that the Indo-European languages are the most widely spoken in the world today. In Europe, with the sole exception of Basque, which somehow mysteriously survived, the indigenous European languages went extinct and were completely replaced with Indo-European languages. Now, before some of you say, but what about Hungarian? Yes, Today, there are indeed non-Indo-European languages in Europe. As well as Hungarian, Finnish, and Estonian, there are a couple of dozen languages used in the European part of Russia. Karelian, Moksha, Mari, Komi, Chechen, Ossetian, not to mention Tatar, are not Indo-European languages. But those languages arrived in later migratory waves, well after Indo-European languages had supplanted their predecessors. And unlike Basque, they are not descended from the prehistoric indigenous languages of Europe. So, linguists tell us that the Proto-Indo-Europeans lived in the Caspian Pontic steppe around 4000 BCE. They had a patriarchal family structure. They lived in clans or tribes with chieftains but not kings. Their gods were the sky and the earth. They rode horses and drove wagons and chariots. They ate horses as well as pigs, cows and sheep. They were pastoralist and did not practice agriculture. They liked honey and made mead for special occasions. Join me next episode as we go into the Kurgans and take a look at the fascinating archaeology of the Eastern European plain and the steppe. Does what archaeologists have been finding from Ukraine to the Altai Mountains, much of it only excavated since the 1990s, support the linguistic reconstructions? Or does it tell us something completely different? Check out the socials for maps and pictures to go with the episode at the Russian Empire History Podcast on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. If this episode has piqued your interest in paleolinguistics, I've shared some links to further reading on this fascinating subject. Please follow or subscribe to the podcast at Spotify or the podcatcher of your choice and share with your friends. You can reach me through Facebook or at hello@therussianempirehistorypodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will join me next time.